Modern Love, the podcast, is made possible with support from Living Proof.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Living Proof's dry shampoo is so good at actually cleaning hair that you can take a spin class and not wash your hair after. Use the code LOVE at livingproof.com for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the Living Proof. And by Squarespace, providing tools that help people showcase their passions with a customized landing page, website, or online store. Also offering domains, hosting, and 24/7 support. Get your free trial at squarespace.com/modernlove. You should. Squarespace.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. It is rare, very rare, for Alzheimer's to be viewed as a blessing. But Robert Leleux says the disease changed his family's life for the better. Here's his Modern Love piece, A Memory Magically Interrupted, read by the Oscar and Golden Globe-nominated actor Michael Shannon.
Your grandmother has Alzheimer's, right? The doctor asked me, scrawling notes into a floppy manila folder. I hadn't expected to discuss my grandmother's Alzheimer's with him. I was hoping to hear some explanation as to why, apart from her memory, my grandmother's overall health seemed so mysteriously improved. Her lupus, for instance, had all but disappeared from her blood work. Yes, but I began. Well, there is a theory, he said, interrupting, that people with Alzheimer's heal themselves of their diseases because they forget they have them. I glanced across the room at my beautiful grandmother, smiling vaguely in her lipstick pink trench coat. But you don't really believe that, I said. The doctor shrugged with an implicit, who knows? Which I found irritating, because I hadn't flown all the way from Manhattan to Nashville to discuss fanciful theories. I wanted solid answers about Joanne's health, and he'd thrown me with his talk of miracle cures. But by that evening, after I had driven my grandparents home, I realized that the real reason this doctor had startled me was that for the first time I'd heard someone confirm my experience of my grandmother's disease. Alzheimer's has, in a sense, healed my grandmother and our family. 5 years ago, when Joanne's Alzheimer's was first diagnosed, I couldn't imagine anything less fair. At the time, I composed a mental list of all the people I knew who could lose their minds without anybody noticing. Scores of people whom I've never heard say one original thing. While my grandmother, on the other hand, was the genius of the cocktail party, a brunette version of our fellow Texan Ann Richards, who always seemed poised with a staggering stiletto quip. As a young artist in New York, I'd spent years trying to find my voice. When I did, it was my grandmother's. To this day, I've never liked anything I've created that didn't somehow remind me of her. So the fact that my clumsy development and slow self-discovery was occurring just as her decline began felt like a tragic bargain. I was finding my voice just as she was losing hers. The only certainty about Alzheimer's is that it's characterized by uncertainty. There is no definitive test, no definitive diagnosis. So throughout that year, as my grandfather and I accompanied her to a legion of new doctors, each of whom mentioned the possibility of Alzheimer's, my grandmother grew ever more foggy. Sometimes hilariously so. The wonderful thing about Alzheimer's, she would say, unfurling her arm like Betty Davis, is that you always live in the moment. Like many Southern women of her generation, my grandmother had been a stifled lady, prone to fits of drape-drawn depression, medicated with champagne and Streisand. Sad lives make funny people, she told me when I was 16. Humor was the way she had coped with every unpleasant thing in her life, from her long estrangement from my mother, her only child, to the onset of a crippling disease. But while my grandmother was able to laugh at her decline, her husband couldn't. He didn't find anything funny about watching her forget their life together. I think all my grandfather ever wanted was to be left alone with his wife, a goal he'd finally accomplished after more than 40 years of marriage when they retired from Houston to his family's Tennessee home. In this way, my grandparents reminded me of the Reagans, one of those couples who are so gaga for each other that there is no room for the kids. It's nobody's fault. It's just that perfect couples rarely have happy families. They have to have children because they love each other too much not to make something of it, but then the honeymoon never ends. And who brings their children on a honeymoon? It's like they always say, two's company, and three's an angry kid like Patty Davis, desperate for attention, with a complex about being shoved outside the magic circle. Except that in our case, Patty Davis was my mother, a Scarlett O'Hara for the Silicon Age, with a chest as big as her mouth and hair. Between these two genteel Southern ladies, our family became an Old West town. It just wasn't big enough for both of them. Which meant that my grandfather, Alfred, adoring Joanne as he did, not only stopped speaking to his daughter, he even stopped speaking about her, at least with me, until the day when we were finally forced to accept the fact of Joanne's Alzheimer's and its awful progression. The more Joanne forgot, the more often Alfred asked me to visit. And at the end of one of these Tennessee weekends, he suddenly blurted, "Sonny, I think it's time your mother came home for a visit." I was too surprised to say anything. Then he repeated, "I think it's time your mother came home." "I'll make it happen," I mumbled. "Good," he said, tapping the wheel. "It's time." Of course, I had no idea how I would make it happen. Fortunately, my mother, who for many years had been no stranger to a Bloody Mary, was newly sober, and I took advantage of that narrow window of Alcoholics Anonymous time before making amends becomes a crashing bore. All that summer, I begged her, long distance. I swore that if she would only visit her parents one more time, everything would be different. Finally, I played my ace. I asked her to visit them in Tennessee for my birthday in September.
"Damn it," she screeched. "So now if I don't go, I'll be ruining your birthday." "Fine, I'll do it. But prepare yourself for disaster."
"There won't be any disaster," I said.
"Oh, really? Give me one good reason why things will be different this time."
"Alzheimer's," I answered. For my grandfather and me, having to witness Joanne's Alzheimer's had been agonizing, like watching the miracle worker backward. Every day seemed accompanied by a new limitation. But for my grandmother, the disease seemed liberating. For the first time in all the years I'd known her, she'd seemed truly happy. Imagine, to be freed from your memory, to have every awful thing that ever happened to you wiped away, and not just your past, but your worries about the future, too. Because with no sense of time or memory, past and future ceased to exist, along with all sense of loss and regret. And that's the fantasy, isn't it? There had always been an element of existential fury to my grandmother's barbed wit concerning her lost time and missed chances. But as her Alzheimer's advanced, she forgot to be angry. And she seemed healthier, too. Her pace quickened, her complexion brightened, her hair thickened. And with my help and her husband's credit card, even her wardrobe improved. Her transformation was magical and unmistakable. It was certainly unmistakable to my mother, on that bracing September day when my grandparents and I picked her up at the Nashville airport.
"Look, Joanne," Alfred said, "it's Jessica."
"Isn't that funny," said Joanne before embracing my mother. "That's my daughter's name, too." My mother forced a smile and shot me a wary look that abruptly softened once we got to the Buick and my grandmother reached for her hand.
"Tell me all about yourself, darling," she said. "I want to know everything about you."
All through my birthday dinner that evening, Joanne positively doted on her daughter, beaming sweetly and patting her hand. This behavior unsettled my mother, who afterward made a theatrical production of rooting through the closet in her bedroom. "What are you doing?" I asked.
"Looking for space pods," she said. "Who are those people, Robert, and what have they done with my mother? I keep thinking I must be in a blackout, that I must be drunk in a ditch somewhere, and when I wake up I'll have the hangover of a lifetime, because believe me, if that nice old lady had been my mother, I'd never have left home."
Now that my grandmother had, in a way, disappeared, she was fully present to my mother for perhaps the first time in their relationship. Now that she was all but unreachable, she was finally available. Each evening as Joanne scooted close at dinner, my mother found the nearness less nerve-wracking. On the last day, as we were leaving for the airport, my grandfather kissed us goodbye. Suddenly, Joanne grabbed onto the lapels of my mother's jacket as if she were about to shake her. My mother looked rattled, but then Joanne said,
"Thank you for coming, Jessica. I want you to know how much it means to me. I want you to know that I know we've never been close, and I know that's been mostly my fault. I'm not sure how much time I've got, but more than anything, I want to have a shot at spending it with you. It's so important. I mean, after all, Jessica, we're sisters."
I groaned, then looked over to see my tough mother crying.
"Close enough, Mama," she said.
Academy Award-nominated actor Michael Shannon reading Robert Lulu's essay.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
A memory magically interrupted. Well, by now, I bet you're wondering, how did Robert's mom feel about the essay? We'll find out when we come back.
I'm Katie at Living Proof, and we get love letters all the time, like this one. "Dear Living Proof, I've used so many dry shampoos, but my hair still gets greasy, and I wear a ponytail by day 3. Your dry shampoo has my hair so clean and full of body that it's still down on day 4. This is the most effective dry shampoo I've ever used. Love, Kat." You can use the code LOVE for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. Livingproof.com.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and with me now is Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. Dan, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Also with us is the author of this week's essay, Robert Lulu. Robert, thanks for joining us.
How do you do? It's such a pleasure to be here.
It's such a pleasure to have you. So I'm eager to know how your mom responded to having her story told in Modern Love.
Well, my mother is a great sport, you know, because this was not the first time I had written about her. But she's not a softie, if you know what I mean. And so my having kind of written about her kind of caving to her mother's affection, it actually was uncomfortable for my mother to have me chronicle. And she was very, very generous about me doing it.
The thing that really grabbed me about this particular column is, of course, you know, no matter how fraught relationships between children and their mothers might be, at the end, when your mom tells your grandmother, close enough, I could just feel it. I feel that. Like, when my, I love my mom too, and sometimes we don't get along either, but like, you know, when she just kind of gives me that nod in whatever way that nod
right,
is,
yeah.
And you just feel like, yeah, like close enough. Is sometimes,
you know, my mother actually, my mother lives with me. I don't know if you know this.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. So, Daniel, you'll be getting another.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Submission pretty soon. You know, I worship and adore my mother. And I feel like, you know, if you're a gay guy and you have, and you're lucky enough to have your, it's like getting the gay Oscar, you know, for your mother to move in with you, you know, so it's wonderful. And all kidding aside, like, if you go through your life feeling like your mother isn't fond of you, or your mother isn't, you know, doesn't approve of you, it does something to you. Mm-hmm. That's no joke. To have that change in the third act of her life profoundly changed her worldview. She's now about to go to law school, you know, so that she can do pro bono work for women's rights and for the rights of children. And it's because of the excruciating experience of my grandmother's Alzheimer's that we would never have chosen
right.
in a million years, and yet enabled this intimacy that was absolutely transformative.
What kind of response did you get after your column was published?
I've never experienced such a sense of closeness with people. I heard, I received hundreds of letters, but one, a man whose father had been in a concentration camp, and his family had always said, I wish you'd known your father before he was in Auschwitz, because, God, what a lovely young man. Then he got Alzheimer's, and he wrote me this line. He said, Alzheimer's was the only thing that was able to take away the bitterness of my father's experience of having been in that concentration camp.
I mean, what I love about this story and what I found so moving is this idea that relationships can be reconstructed late in life, and relationships that were given up on, in this case, such an important relationship between mother and daughter that was just in a deep freeze, can be reconstructed because her memory is wiped out.
Well, and that's the heartbreaking irony of it, isn't it?
Yeah, to me it was, because I feel like you have relatives you love and you have relatives you like, you know? And and then there's another category. There's a category of person you almost feel like you've been sent to this planet to fulfill or to replace in some way. And my grandmother was that person for me. You know, like, whatever might be special about me, and that's up to debate, was much more special about she was the original, and I am the indistinct photocopy. And so writing about it was such a mixed bag of emotion.
Yeah.
It's a totally unique experience in my life.
Well, it's also such a great way to end our conversation. Robert Lilla is author of this week's Modern Love essay, A Memory Magically Interrupted. He has a new coffee table book coming out this spring called Southern Style Now. Robert, thank you again so much.
Thank you very much.
And Dan Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
Special thanks to Michael Shannon, who read this week's essay. He was recently nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor in 99 Homes. And you can see him next month in the sci-fi drama Midnight Special. And he stars as Elvis Presley opposite Kevin Spacey in the movie Elvis and Nixon, which comes out this spring. Next week on Modern Love, Tony Award-winning actor Patina Miller brings us a story of love, light, and darkness.
In the abstract, blindness is epic, noble, simple. In reality, it's tedious, draining, messy. It's a lot like the reality of being married.
what's coming up next week. And 2 weeks from now, we have an episode that's all about taking a leap of faith. So we want to hear your stories about a time you took a leap of faith for love. But here's the challenge. We'd like you to do it in 3 sentences or less. So write it down or record a voice memo and email it to modernlove@wbur.org. And don't forget to tell us where you're from so we can add you to the Modern Love map on our website. Again, that's modernlove@wbur.org. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It is produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Megan Chakrabarty. Thanks for listening.